Evolution versus science. Scientists who accept the theory of evolution are very concerned today. They're very concerned that so many people don't accept evolution. And I think the evidence for this concern is seen in all of the newspaper, periodical, TV presentations saying, evolution is a fact. We know that. And of course, your president got into the act a couple of weeks ago by saying that he thought it was quite all right for intelligent design to be taught in the schools. And this has opened another whole can of worms. And everybody's after him. I had KGO San Francisco on Friday night, and the host of the Open Line show spent 45 minutes knocking President Bush and his belief in intelligent design and so on. So it's a very apropos subject right now. I thought we should start with a couple of definitions. And this first one is by the editor-in-chief of National Geographic magazine. And he defined evolution this way: the myriad species inhabiting the earth are a result of repeated branching from a common ancestor. And I think I want you to remember this whole idea as we go through. The idea of a common ancestor is, I hear coming out more and more. You know, well, people didn't evolve from apes. They evolved from a common ancestor. But as has been said, if you ever saw that common ancestor, you would call it an ape. So there's not much difference there. Well, of course, here's one of the branching areas that we talk about. And yes, if you take this definition, it means you have to go all the way back until there was just one ancestor, and from that, everything evolved. Here, perhaps, is another place of diversion there. You can see from there the evolutionary tree of life. They show birds and mammals and human beings all having a common ancestor back at that point. So evolution says everything came from a common ancestor. Well, what about science? Well, I like this definition of science. Science is a search for truth. And I think all scientists, regardless of their basic belief, if you ask them, do you want to find the truth, they would probably say yes. That's what I'm looking for. I'm researching, and I want to find out what's really true. And so we're going to be contrasting this as we go through tonight. A few years ago, a number of people in the province of Ontario approached the Ministry of Education and said, you know, we really don't know how old the sun is. That's just a guess to say that it's 5 billion years old. So do you think we should really be asking students to say on their provincial exams the sun is 5 billion years? And they got a hearing at the Ministry of Education, and so they announced that from that time on, students would not be asked on provincial exams to say that the sun is 5 billion years old. Well, that opened a can of worms too. And shortly after, a letter appeared in the Globe and Mail, one of Canada's national newspapers, and this was the gist of his letter. Creationists have a right to believe that the sun is only 8,000 years old, or one day old if they wish, to disbelieve the theory of evolution, and the right to publicize their beliefs no matter how ridiculous. That was kind of him, wasn't it? To do all that. But it was the next sentence that really hit me. Democracy rightly defends people's right to be wrong, but it does not require us to pretend that what is wrong may be right. And I thought, how many things in evolution are scientists pretending they're right, or really they're wrong? So that's what I want to look at tonight, evolution versus science. Keith Devlin, Stanford University, very recently made the same sort of statement. Anyone is entitled to believe in intelligent design if they wish, but beliefs should not be passed off as scientific theory. So let's keep that in mind as we go through this tonight as well. Beliefs should not be passed off as scientific theory. Evolution versus science. Pretending that what is wrong may be right. Jonathan Wells in Icons of Evolution makes this statement. related to the talk tonight. If there is such overwhelming evidence for Darwinian evolution, why do our biology textbooks, science magazines, and television nature documentaries keep recycling the same tired old myths? And I'm sure if you've read that book, you know he takes 10 different myths and shows why they are myths. So again, pretending that what is wrong may be right. So the first pretense is this. All scientists accept evolution. You'll hear that over and over again. Well, and I know you'll recognize a number of these names, but I just want to show you that there are a few scientists that don't accept evolution. There are astronomers, there are astrophysicists, there are geologists, there are biochemists, and the list actually goes on. There are physical chemists, there are geneticists, mathematicians. There's a book, you may have seen this one as well, In 6 Days, in which 50 scientists explain why they choose to believe in six-day creation. How do evolutionists then come about saying all scientists believe in evolution? Look at the quotation here from Stephen Jay Gould. Professionally trained scientists, virtually to a person, understand the factual basis of evolution and don't dispute it. Now, I think that little phrase, virtually to a person, means every one of them. Okay? They all understand the factual basis of evolution and don't dispute it. Well, I showed you a few names there. Many of you are familiar with the Creation Research Society. They publish this journal, and they have hundreds of scientists, members there, with master's and PhD degrees, who do not accept evolution. So how does Stephen Jay Gould convince himself that all scientists believe in evolution? Well, look at the first part of his statement. Creationists are religious fundamentalists, not scientists. So what he does is redefine a scientist. A scientist is a person that does not believe in creation. So, all scientists believe in evolution, because you have eliminated the ones that believe in creation. Okay, so the first myth, that all scientists believe in creation, believe in evolution. The truth is, many scientists do not accept evolution, and I've shown you a few examples there. Pretense two, all scientific evidence supports evolution. Well, let's take a look at some of these. Henry Morris has written this little book, The Scientific Case Against Evolution. I'll just point out four of the evidences that he mentions here. The first one, no one has ever seen it happen. Now, we have some skeptics here, and hopefully there might be some who believe in evolution, and however, they're going to challenge me on that. Oh, we've seen it happen. As a matter of fact, you may have seen the National Geographic from last November, an article, Was Darwin Wrong? And first of all, you get your hopes up and think, hey, maybe they're going to really come down to the truth here. You open up the magazine and what do you see? A great big no, Darwin was right. And they go on in the in this National Geographic and point out how evolution has been seen. Now, in the article, I want to sort of set the stage for what they're talking about here. They define anagenesis. They define it this way: slow evolutionary change within a single species. That's how the magazine article defined anagenesis, and makes the comment, most evolution proceeds too slowly to be observed by a single scientist within a research lifetime. Now, it's a statement right out of the article, and yet they're saying, oh, we've seen evolution happen. But that's only one type of change. They defined another type of change, speciation. And here, a lineage splits into two species. Okay, so the first one was change within a species, and now speciation, where it splits into two species. It's rarer and even more elusive than anagenesis. Now, if anagenesis proceeds too slowly to be observed, and speciation is even rarer and harder to see, then I suggest that maybe evolution hasn't been seen. However, the article goes on to say that it has. And Peter and Rosemary Grant are two scientists who spent 20 years on little island in the Galapagos archipelago, Daphne Major, and studied finch evolution. Now, you have to admire these people. This is a deserted island. I mean, there's nothing there. Very small. They lived there not full time, back and forth to the U.S. and back to the island. They measured the beaks of every finch on the island. Measured the length and the width and the depth, and put all their figures into their computer, and did some things with it, and so on. They at one point, they had estimated that there were 1,200 finches on this island, and they measured the beaks of every one of them. And after a drought, there were about 175 finches left. So that many had died out. Now, of course, evolution requires death. And it's those who are not as well adapted to survive die out. And so the Grants found that the finches with the larger beaks were able to open the seeds that were the last of the seeds that were left after the drought. So the finches with the smaller beaks, they could eat the seeds, were easier to get to. But then as food got more and more scarce, only the ones with the larger beaks were able to open the seeds and survive. And that's why they figured that only 175 survived. And so they felt that they had seen evolution. My wife and I were in the Galapagos Islands in May, and in their center there, where they show the all the research and that sort of thing, their interpretive center, that's the word I wanted. They have a statement on the wall that evolution is revealed by these little birds, these finches. There is no better evidence of evolution. That was the exact statement. Now, what did the Grants find? They found that the average porpoise beak before a drought was 10.8 millimeters long by 9.4 millimeters deep. The average beak of the porpoise that survived the drought was 11.07 millimeters long by 9.96 millimeters deep. Now, when you do the arithmetic, less than a millimeter, about half a millimeter. The change in the size of the beak was half a millimeter. And that, according to the Interpretive Center, is the best evidence for evolution. Now, this is change within a species. It's just the one species. I suggest that evolution has not been observed, as Henry Morris said. There's lots of people doing this research. I don't know how familiar with you are there. The finches in the Galapagos Islands, the sparrows on Mandarte Island, a little island not too far from here. I had never heard about it before. I had to look it up on the website and see where it was. How many of you have heard of Mandarte Island? It's just off the coast of Sydney, British Columbia, which isn't too far off to the west here. Stickleback fish from Texada Island, guppies from the rivers of northern South America. These are bacteria. They're researching all of these and saying, we're seeing evolution. Well, what they're seeing is a tiny, tiny change within one species. But that is evolution, as far as they're concerned. What did the editor-in-general and editor-in-chief of the National Geographic say? All the myriad species living on Earth. Now, there's no evidence then for change from one species to another, from one, I like to use the biblical word, one kind to another, and remind you that kind is not species, they're not synonymous, but there's no evidence for that. Well, let's move on. Yes, the myriad species. So that's what the evolutionist has to explain. Where did all these species come from? So no one has ever seen it happen. The transitional fossils are missing. They're just not there. Yes, there are some suggestions, and I'm going to mention a few later, but I won't take any more time on that. The transitional fossils are not there. DNA studies lead to unlikely relationships. Of course, this is the newest line of approach. Let's look at the DNA. Let's look at the molecular level and see what the connections are there. And Henry Morris points out this one. He talks about the elephant shrew. I think you can see why it's called the elephant shrew. He has a fairly strange nose there. Now, the question is he closer related to the elephant or to the shrew? And DNA studies show that he is more closely related to the elephant, whereas I would suggest that he really is more closely related to the shrew, being of that same kind. And another evidence against evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics, which very simply says that, I know you can't talk about the second law simply, but that things deteriorate, become less complex, and yet evolution requires greater degree of complexity throughout history in order to get all of the myriad species on Earth. So there is evidence that does not agree with evolution. Let's move on to the third pretense. There is no limit to change. And this myth has to be considered to be right, even though it's wrong, has to be considered to be right, because to get all of the myriad species from one common ancestor, you have to have unlimited change. Well, what sort of evidence do we have here then? Well, it was fruit flies. Fruit flies have been studied in thousands and thousands of generations. We had short-winged flies, curly-winged flies, orange-eyed flies, eyeless flies, but they've always been flies. Never produced something else. Someone said, we've never produced a bumblebee. And the researcher replied, I wasn't trying to get a bumblebee. If I had been, I would be able to get one. Well, that's just not true. If he'd been able to get a bumblebee, he sure would have. So there is a limit to change. There are still fruit flies. James Perloff in Tornado in a Junkyard makes this statement. If controlled conditions and intelligent planning cannot transform a species, the fruit fly, how much less could natural selection operating under chance conditions without intelligence? So the intelligent planning can't produce different kinds. Natural selection could not. Then we take a look at the dogs. Lots of different types of dogs have been bred. Very large ones, very small ones, but you'll never be able to breed a dog as large as a Clydesdale horse, or as small as a mouse, although we've gotten pretty small. But there are limits to change. In reading a book by Edward Larson, Evolution's Workshop, God and Science on the Galapagos Islands, I found this very interesting statement. Darwin followed Lyell in viewing species as variable only within prescribed limits. And Lyell said, there is a capacity in all species to accommodate themselves to a certain extent to a change of external circumstances. So when Darwin was on the Galapagos Islands, he thought that there was a limit to change. However, when he got back to England and working on his theory, he realized that there had to be unlimited change if he was to come up with the evolution of all the myriad species on Earth. So he changed in this. But again, change is limited. Now, where do people go wrong? And I think it's in the idea of the fixity of species. Rudy Baum, editor-in-chief of Chemical Engineering News, writes this. The clash between scientists who understand evolution as the organizing principle of modern biology and people most, but not all, non-scientists who reject evolution and insist on a divine origin of life as it exists today on Earth. And what Darwin, we find this in his writing, and I find most scientists today say, you people that believe in creation, believe that God created life as it exists today on Earth. In other words, Darwin was taught fixity of species. He thought that the Bible said species could not change. And this is where we run into the problem of kind and species. So kind in scripture does not refer to species. And so over and over again, I'm seeing scientists saying, you people think that life is fixed. As we see it today, it's exactly how God created it. We have made changes in dogs and apples and you name it. Therefore, you're wrong, because change is possible. We don't deny that change is possible. We see that in the dogs and the fruit flies and so on. But the change is limited. Species are not fixed. Kinds are fixed, as we read about in Scripture. So the truth is that genetic changes are not without limit. Lots of change. The Creator made the possibility of creatures to adapt, to change, to fit their environment, but they're not without limit. I sometimes refer to the pine tree, and maybe it's the same here. When a particular pine tree grows in the interior of British Columbia, it goes straight and tall, called lodgepole pines, because they may use them for their lodges. You take those seeds and plant them on the coast, they don't grow straight and tall at all. They're rather twisted and so on because of a different environment. So they can change within an environment. Pretense four. Fossils show a perfect continuity of evolving species. We'll hear this over and over again. Many sequences, evolution say, where we have this continuity, you can trace the development of a species from one organism to a different organism. Well, we looked at this tree of life before, but I think a quote from Stephen Jay Gould is applicable here. He said, the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of the branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. So I think that indicates that there is not this perfect continuity of fossils from one organism to another. This is a picture of early fish, according to the biology textbook, Miller and Levine. Where did they come from? From the invertebrate jellyfish? From the invertebrate trilobite? There are no fossils found in there. Thousands of observable intermediates just aren't observable. They're not there. There is not this perfect continuity from one form to another. How about the horse? A favorite series. Students are taught that the horse is a perfect example of evolution. You can see it changing from one to the other. Of course, as we were saying, lots of variability, but apart from the Eohippus at the beginning there, all the others were clearly horses of different sizes. And there's no evidence that the one actually lived after the other. There's no sequential time period here. The Microsoft Encarta Encyclopedia says the horse is a well-documented case study in evolution. The fossil record shows clear steps in the progression from a four-toed small browsing animal, one of a line that gave rise to tapirs, rhinoceroses, and other mammals, in addition to the horse, the modern horse. So this is what is taught, this is what is understood. Okay, pretending that what is wrong may be right. Nicholas Comnenus in Creative Defense makes this statement about horses. However, today we know that the three-toed and one-toed horses live together in North America. The fact that varieties of horses coexisted is completely
inconsistent with evolution's explanations. It said that what thought to be a line, a tree of development from one from the other has turned to be a bush, because they're all growing there together. They find their fossils together, and there isn't that sequence from one to the other, a perfect sequence of development. And he goes on to add that missing links between Heracotherium, Myohippus, and Equus have never been identified. So the evidence is just not there. But what about whales? This is the favorite. We have a fellow who describes himself as a Christian evolutionist at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, and he claims that there is perfect evidence for the evolution of whales. Now, I'm not quite sure how his Christian faith and evolution go together here, but he's certainly written on this. So here the textbook Biology Visualizing Life has this statement. For instance, modern whales are the descendants of four-legged animals, land animals, that are also the ancestors of horses and cows. As you can see in the figure, fossil intermediates between modern whales and their 60 million year old ancestor reveal a history of slow transformation. Really? Well, they show a Masonicid there at the top, 60 million years, he's dated at. Notice the next one down is 50 million. Well, that's quite a long time, isn't it? 10 million years with no other intermediate. And then 40 million years, and then nothing shown between 40 and zero. So there just isn't the perfect continuity from one to the other. But Philip Gingrich, who's done a lot of research on the whales, talked for some time, and this statement is made in this book in 1998, as you see. Philip Gingrich was referred to in the National Geographic article. It tells how he, in researching in Pakistan, found a bone, at least one of the people working with him, found a bone, and then a few days later they found another bone, and he put these two together, and he realized that it was the ankle bone of a walking whale. And he realized that he was wrong, that whales had not evolved from meat-eating Masonicids, and evolved from herbivores like antelopes and arteriodactyls, if you want the word. So this one bone convinced him that whales had evolved from antelopes. In Kenneth Miller, Finding Darwin's God, there's the Ambulocetus, the walking whale, a skeleton drawn in this book. There's the reconstruction, and there's the actual bones that were found. So what is the evidence that these were whales, or that they were walking whales? And did all these bones go together? You notice that they were not articulated. You didn't find the whole skeleton, but bits and pieces. So again, pretending that what is wrong may be right. Pakasetus, whale from Pakistan. There's the artist's reconstruction. Again, notice the portions that were found, just a couple of bones from the skull. Remember what we're thinking about here, that there is a perfect continuity of fossils, intermediate fossils, from one to the other. They're just not there. John Woodmorafi makes this statement, all of the postcranial bones indicate postcranial, that means behind the head, for those of you who aren't up on the scientific terms here. All of the postcranial bones indicate that Pakasetids were land mammals, and it is likely they would have been thought of as some primitive arteriodactyls if they had been found without their skulls. The skulls and the bones were not found together. And at one point, in the National Geographic article, it says that they had the skeletons, they had the skulls, and they didn't know what to do with them, and somebody decided to put them together and make a walking whale. Francis Hitching Life magazine says the fossils are often missing in the most important places. These most important places are the transitions between major types of animals. The fossils are not there. Ernst Mayr from Harvard University one time makes this statement. I think this is an excellent summary then of what I've been saying about the fossil record. Given the fact of evolution, one would expect the fossils to document a gradual, steady change from ancestral forms to the descendants, but this is not what the paleontologists find. Instead, he or she finds gaps in just about every phyletic series. So, do we find a perfect continuity of fossils? No, evolution is a matter of faith, pretending that what is wrong may be right. Fossils do not show a perfect continuity of evolving species. Pretense 5. Human-like footprints can be made by non-human animals. I don't know how many of you saw the film Footprints in Stone. It's been withdrawn, but many years ago it was very popular. And they interviewed one evolutionist on there, and I remember him saying, The best thing I can say about these footprints is that they were made by some unknown two-legged animal with feet like human feet. Well, what sort of animals have human feet? And I think it's human beings. Anyway, where are these footprints? Well, they were found in Laetoli, Tanzania, by Mary Leakey, and they were dated at 3.5 million years. Who made these footprints? Lucy, the skeleton Lucy, was discovered 4 years before, 1974. It was claimed that this skeleton was 3.5 million years old. Oh, so we have a 3.5 million year skeleton, 3.5 million year footprints. That skeleton must have made the footprints. There's the skeleton. And on the right, you see a artist reconstruction. Notice how similar the foot there in the reconstruction is to the foot in the fossil? There is no foot in the fossil. The foot bone was not found. But there's the reconstruction. It even gets better. Here's the reconstruction in a textbook in Science of Biology. Notice how human that foot is. But anatomist Jack Stern and Randall Sussman described Lucy's hands and feet as being long and curved, typical of a tree down ape. Now, they weren't found, but what they're going on there then is that similar skeletons of size for apes living today are indeed long and curved. So the textbooks are showing feet, and the zoos where these are displayed, showing feet like human feet. Well, I won't ask you to embarrass yourself by guessing which foot is human, but there's the human foot. I think that's fairly obvious. Look at the difference between ape and human footprints. The ape tends to walk on the side of its foot. As human beings, we heel, cross the ball, and out through the big toe. So there's a very definite difference between the way apes walk and humans walk. There's the Laetoli footprint. Notice how human that is. Tim White, Evolutionary Implications of Pleistocene Hominid Footprints, makes this statement. The uneroded footprints show a total morphological pattern like seen in modern humans. Now, these are scientists, not necessarily creationists, who are describing these Laetoli footprints. They are indistinguishable from those of habitually barefoot Homo sapiens. Indistinguishable. They look like human feet. Donald Johansson, Maitland Eady, in their book, there is a well-shaped modern heel with a strong arch and a good ball of the foot in front of it. The big toe is straight in line. It doesn't stick out the side like an ape toe. Everybody that sees these footprints says they look like human footprints. Someone asked Mary Leakey, Do you think these footprints you've discovered might have been formed by human beings? And her reply, surely you know there were no human beings around at that time. Okay, so you see what's happening here. Commitment to evolution. Footprints are dated at 3.5 million years old. There aren't supposed to be human beings around at that time, therefore they couldn't have made the footprint. Rather than saying, we have some solid evidence of human footprints, there must have been human beings around at that time, so either our dating scale is all wrong, or there are human beings around here 3.5 million years ago. But no, there's no attempt to acknowledge that they may be made by human beings. So who made these footprints? Well, I suggest that human beings made these footprints, and not 3.5 million years ago. Philip Johnson, in Defeating Darwinism, takes a page out of Carl Sagan's book and encourages us to tune up our baloney detectors. Of course, Sagan was saying that people should look for baloney in what creationists were saying. But let's take a look at some of the baloney in what evolutionists are saying. We've looked at some of this, false information or selective use of evidence, as in the finches and so on, maybe misleading information. Well, we can look for fuzzy words, like we believe, we think, and we haven't seen it, we believe this, think this, given enough time, it will happen. It might work, must have formed, as in these life forms must have evolved in the absence of oxygen. Well, why must they have evolved? Well, because of the commitment to evolution. Could possibly have been, my guess is, seems like, okay, these are some of the fuzzy words that you find. Let's look at a few quotations here. In Biology Visualizing Life, another important find was the footprints of a group of bipedal animals. Of course, they're referring to the Laetoli footprints. They reveal small but very human-like feet. Well, bipedal animals are human beings. They're not, there's no other animal that walks like human beings walk, or with feet like human feet. Here it comes. Okay. Biology, principles and explorations. Lucy's leg bones indicate that she must have walked upright. Okay, here we have again the same idea. Must have done this. We don't really know for sure, but, well, she must have, because we need some bipedal, upright-walking creatures at that point. Biology, concepts and connections. Some 3.7 million years ago, several bipedal, upright-walking human animals of the species Australopithecus afarensis left footprints in deep volcanic ash in what is now Tanzania, East Africa. But just a minute. Australopithecus is the genus, and it means southern ape. These aren't human animals. So here again, you see the putting in the idea that these are human animals, but they're not. They are apes, Australopithecus. All researchers agree on certain basic facts. We know, for example, that humans evolved from ancestors we share with other living primates, such as chimpanzees and apes. Well, all researchers? No, I've given you a list of many scientists that don't agree on that. Facts? No. We know that humans evolve? No. We don't know any of these things. So, let's tune up our baloney detectors as we read National Geographic and watch television programs and so on, and just listen for these words that indicate that the researchers really don't know what is truth. Otter's depiction. This is another one. The artist's depiction. I've noticed in science news recently lots of pictures of planets and you know, just discovered this planet or that planet and so on. And then you read the small print, artist's depiction. So I'm sure a lot of students think that astronomers have actually taken pictures of planets outside our solar system. But we haven't. They're just artist's depictions. So the truth is, the human footprints are not made by non-human beings. So if you find a human footprint, it must mean that there was a human being there. This is the latest, I think, myth, pretending what is wrong may be right. Computer-generated digital organisms evolved by themselves. Don't know if you saw Discover Magazine in February 2005. Testing Darwin. Scientists at Michigan State prove evolution works. Now, what did these scientists do? They developed a computer program in which computer-generated organisms evolved. Now, I think this demonstrates the lack of evidence for evolution from fossils and from living organisms. If there was solid evidence from the fossils, I don't think people would be going into their computers to try to prove evolution. Now, these scientists actually, they make this statement. Things evolve regardless. We can't stop them evolving. Evolution is a, he said, we didn't invent the law. Darwin discovered it, the law of evolution. And these computer-generated organisms prove that evolution works. What they've done is created a program in which there are some fixed instructions, but there are a number of random instructions. And the program allows the random instructions to change, and when the whole set of instructions then does something like adding two numbers, this is saved. This particular one is retained, and so it goes on adding numbers. Here's what they say. Each time a digital organism replicated, there was a small chance that one of its command lines might mutate. Yes, because there were all of these random instructions in there that could change randomly. But the instructions had to be put in there, I'm quite sure. Those command lines didn't originate on their own, they were just allowed to change. So while they did not start with command lines that were that said to add two things, because of the random changes that occurred, a command line came up, and they're calling it an organism. It's a command. An organism could add two numbers. All the core parts, this is these scientists at Michigan State University, all the core parts of the Darwinian process are there. These things replicate, they mutate, they're competing with one another. The very process of natural selection is happening there. There's in a computer. These are command lines in a computer program. They replicate, yes, because there's an instruction in there that once a certain command is developed, that is copied. So, yes, they are instructed to copy themselves, at least the program makes copies of them. They mutate, yes, because there are random changes built into the program. They compete with one another. They develop this idea of natural selection, the same idea of the finches. You know, the ones with the smaller beaks died out. The ones with the larger beaks didn't, even if it was only a millimeter difference in their beaks. How do they make these compete? Well, if this particular command line can add two numbers, they say it is maintained, it's allowed to reproduce, to copy itself, and carry on adding things. But if it doesn't, after a certain time, it's wiped out. It actually says they go kaboom. They actually use that word. And so, yes, they compete with one another, but only because the human researcher has built that into the program. Notice the changing definitions. definition of life. You could consider a living organism as nothing more than an information channel where it is transmitting its genome to its offspring. So a computer program that contains instructions for making new copies of itself has taken a significant step toward life. So the redefining life. Now it's just a matter of making a copy. Does this mean that your photocopier is alive? It makes lots of copies. A computer program that contains instructions. Somebody had to put those instructions in there. They didn't evolve on their own. This fellow, his name is Pennock. He's a philosopher, by the way. He's not a scientist. He says, I can't get digital organisms to stop adapting. Life will always find a way. Well, life, yes, in some ways it is. You plant a seed and it will find its way through a concrete platform if it's in its way. But they're really twisting things here when they say these things are alive. Reminds me of this cartoon from Randy Weisong's Creation Evolution Controversy. If I can just synthesize life here, I'll have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form life in the beginning. Okay, maybe. I think a lot of intelligence is going in. Metabolism. I like this one. These quotations, by the way, are right out of the Discover magazine, right out of these scientists from Michigan State University. This is their definition of metabolism. Into a cherry tree go carbon dioxide, water, and other nutrients. Out comes wood, cherries, and toxins. Computer program works the same way. Two numbers go in, the computer program adds them, and out comes the sum. This is metabolism, a computer adding to... Let's take a look at metabolism. What goes on? It's not just carbon dioxide, water, and other nutrients sort of getting together and swirling around a bit, and bang, out comes something. I mean, Darwin may have thought that. He couldn't get in and take a look at the cell. But let's take a look at the action of a ribosome. This is one of the things that goes on in metabolism. There is the ribosome, this plain-looking shaped thing down in the middle there. And it is a very, very important organism in the, organelle in the cell. This is a strand of messenger RNA. And those little lines on the top of it are instructions on how to build a protein. So you have all this information in the cell. It's not just a matter of these raw materials sort of going in and swirling around. They have to be treated in exactly the right way. So there's a set of instructions there. Up here we have a transfer RNA, and its job is to go around and find amino acids. And it finds the right amino acid. Each transfer RNA only finds one amino acid. And it comes along, as you can see, if you follow the purple arrows along there, and comes down to where the to the ribosome, and the ribosome is reading the information on the messenger RNA. It takes the correct transfer RNA and puts it in the right place. So eventually, you end up with a protein chain, the rectangles there, all put in the right order. This is one step in metabolism. The taking of, this is how the raw materials are taken and put together to form a cherry tree. It's not just a computer adding two numbers. So notice the fuzziness in the changing of the definitions. How about evolution? Now remember, the editor-in-chief of National Geographic said evolution is the development of the myriad forms, all forms on life. Evolution, Aveda, that's the name of their program, is not a simulation of evolution, it's an instant of it. This is evolution. Computer instructions randomly being changed, eventually coming out adding a couple of numbers. Notice that a computer program evolves only in the sense that cars evolve, airplanes evolve, and any other inanimate objects evolve. And this, of course, the word is used so broadly today. Yes, cars evolve because a change is made, but it's an intelligent change, a design change, and so on. And the computer program evolves just because the scientists have put those instructions in there. Dr. Benjamin Weicker, senior fellow at Discovery Institute, makes this summarizing statement. I thought this really does summarize it up. In order to demonstrate that the development of life doesn't need intelligence to create and guide it, several very intelligent scientists get together and design a complex program run on an ingeniously designed computer to demonstrate that intelligence and design play no part in evolution. Pretending that is wrong may be right. The truth is, computer-generated digital organisms do not evolve by themselves. They have been programmed. The computer has been programmed in such a way to allow that to happen. One more. Pretense. The creator is a distant, impersonal deity of some sort. This is a quotation right out of National Geographic. Louis Mellon, editor-in-chief, National Geographic, concedes evolution does not exclude God from our origins. And there are a lot of people like that. I don't even believe in God. As long as he's far off in time, far off in distance, evolution does not exclude God from our origins. The article went on to say Darwin continued to believe in a distant, impersonal deity of some sort, a greater entity that has set the universe and its laws into motion, but not in a personal God who has chosen humanity as a specially favored species. Now, I think there are a lot of people like that today. They're quite happy to believe that, yeah, back there, billions of years ago, somewhere, God sort of lit the fuse and set the spark going, and so on. But what does the Bible say? When Moses was giving his final message and summary of God's work to the people of Israel, he said, "For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord God is to us?" God is not some distant, impersonal being. God is near. Psalm says, "The Lord is near to all who call upon him, to all who call upon him in truth." In Isaiah 55:6, we read, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near." And here's a call to anyone who has never come to the Lord, never come to the Creator for his forgiveness. The verse, next verse goes on to say, "Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thought. Let him return to the Lord and he will have mercy on him, and to our God he will abundantly pardon." So for all those who confess their need of a Savior, confess their sin, and look for forgiveness, the Lord is near. Who is the Creator? In the New Testament, Colossians, we read, "For by him," that is Jesus, "were all things created that are in heaven and that are on earth." All things were created by him and for him, and he is before all things, and by him all things consist. This is the Creator, Jesus Christ. And what did Jesus say? "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one." And I think you will agree with me that you can't get much closer than being in God's hand. He is not some impersonal, distant deity. He is very near. He is the Creator. Thank you for your attention, Joe.